from 40 hours down to 32. You see bargaining around what they call time banks. So demand is a little unpredictable. Maybe demand is up. The company wants to run the factories longer to meet that demand. You work extra hours those weeks, but you then accumulate a bank of time off so that on average, you're at 32 hours. And of course, you see a more comprehensive welfare state. So, I mean, you could see a scenario where that was going on and where there's an expansion of foreign aid to absorb the extra production that comes from higher productivity by transferring production systems and technology to the third world to make them bigger customers for the stuff that you make, right? That would have been the optimistic scenario. And again, to put that in that kind of, you know, short paragraph, it would have been something like, okay, domestic Keynesianism has run into problems because of these endogenous dynamics. Let's try global Keynesianism, some kind of global class compromise with rising incomes outside the US to facilitate a massive shift of production one level up into the production of capital goods and new technology, which means more humane work, et cetera. And the new international economic order would have been part of that deal. What that was, again, in one sentence trying to do kind of metaphorically was expand the Agricultural Adjustment Act, price stabilization and insurance to raw materials production in the third world. Yeah. So it would have basically a global new deal didn't happen.
So yeah. The road not taken is scaling the system up to the world system.
There would have probably been another intelligence.
Welcome to Reviving Growth Keynesianism, a podcast about economic thought from the mid-20th century and why it matters to us today. Our goal is to fan the flames of a growing conversation on inequality, growth, and aggregate demand, so that we may hopefully arrive at a place of better well-being for all.
Hi, I'm your co-host, Nick Johnson, and I'm coming to you today from the University of Chicago's Center for Spatial Data Science.
And I'm your co-host, Robert Manduca, coming to you from the Department of Sociology at the University of Michigan. Thanks for joining us.
Today, we're joined by Mark Schwartz, professor of politics at the University of Virginia. Mark is the author of numerous articles and books on political economy. And today, we're going to be talking about three recent articles Mark wrote for American Affairs on corporate profit strategies and the economic challenges they create. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Robert. Thanks, Nick.
So to start things off, we often like to ask people a little bit of sort of a biographical question of, you know, how it is that you came to study these topics, in your case, politics, economics, history.
Yeah, so I was always interested in history. I didn't think I was interested in political science as such, or even really economics, and was shopping majors for 2.5 years at my undergrad school and basically not really being settled on any one thing. And then I wandered into this base, you know, the entry level political science course, which was taught at that time by Jim Kurth. And he was basically doing what I now recognize as a kind of classic professor strategy of teaching the article that he was writing. And the article he was writing was on the political consequences of the product cycle, where he took Schumpeter's arguments about growth waves and applied it to power struggles among European and then U.S. For mastery of the global, for control of the global economy. And that got me really interested in Schumpeter. And it also was like, oh, these are interesting questions. And then a semester later, mostly because I was trying to flee the economics department, I wandered into a course by Linda Lim on the history of economic thought, and likewise read all the greatest hits from Ricardo to Keynes. And all these light bulbs started going off in my head about why economics looked the way it did and what the actual real world content of the sort of intellectual struggles were about. So as I said in an article, in the acknowledgments to an article that came out a couple of years ago, you know, I thanked Kurth and Lim for making me read Schumpeter and Keynes as a 20-year-old. And it really set me on this path. And then, not to make too much of a product placement, but if you listeners have a look at my work, my interesting, engaging, and fascinating work, you'll see that it's mostly mostly looks at, you know, big questions, and the influence of Schumpeter and Keynes is pretty evident.
Yeah, it seems your work is like very ecumenical. It's scattered with references to like Veblen and Galbraith and Hilferding and sort of all sorts of really big thinkers that aren't part of the undergraduate economic sequence.
Yeah, well, thank you. That's the thank you to Linda Lim. Otherwise, I would not have known these things, and it would have probably been, oh yeah, this is another between again Kurth and Lim. It would have been, this is another boring field of study where we're trying to parse the electoral behavior of the last 3% of the population, which is interesting work and maybe an important work for many people, but emotionally doesn't do anything for me. And as a creature of emotions and not rationality or the mind, I have to feed the animal within. So I like these big arguments. And I like to see the ways in which they can be updated to account for current circumstances, which is always, I think, the important thing when we think about what is it that Veblen tells us, what is it that Schumpeter tells us that's actually useful and important.
So why don't we get into your articles? So one of the big sort of like central claims is that distributional conflict over profits matters as much for understanding American capitalism as distributional conflict between profits and wages. So can you tell us a little bit about like the main source of profits today as you see them, and some of the distributional conflicts over them, and why that's how that characterizes different eras of American capitalism?
Sure. So first, let me say that the strongest possible framing for the argument is that the distributional conflict across firms for a share of the pool of profits is perhaps even more important than the distributional conflict between capital and labor. That would be a very strong claim. I'm not sure I completely buy into it, but that's the reason that I started this project. The project came out of looking at some data and playing with data. And what I saw was that the Gini index, the index for the level of inequality for profits, was always extremely high, regardless of how you truncated time periods. So I was looking at CompuStat data just for the US economy from the 1950s forward. And what I saw was that typically the Gini hovered around 0.89, or let's just say 0.9. For those of you out there who don't know what the Gini index is or what that number means, the Gini index is a measure of what percentage of a given resource would need to be redistributed to get perfect equality. And so the Gini index goes from zero, nothing has to be redistributed, to, you know, 0.9999, which would be one actor holds everything. And very equal societies like Sweden have Gini indexes for income of about 0.28. And very unequal societies like the US or Brazil are in the 0.5 to 0.6 range. So the level of inequality of profits is actually way higher than anything we see in any society for income. So that was the kind of trigger for like, whoa, what's going on? And then I started thinking about...
And that's constant across the 20th century? Or where do you see the 0.9 figure? Or how late early does that go?
I mean, as early as we have good CompuStat data, which is from the 1950s forward. And we also see it globally. If you take data from the Bureau van Dijk Orbis data set, which is 64 million firms, but because we're talking about where profits eventually end up, that data set has to be truncated two ways. The first is throw out firms that don't have good data. And the second is to only look at global ultimate owners, which is to say the consolidation of overseas subsidiaries and other things into the parent company. That gets you down to a more manageable 20,000 firm. But for the 20,000 global ultimate owners with reasonable data from 2010 forward, and that have sales of $10 million a year annually on average. So we are throwing out a lot of small firms, and I can explain why later. What we see there is the same thing. It's about 0.89, 0.9. Sometimes it's 0.84. I mean, again, it varies, but it's varying in at a very high level. Yeah. So then the question was why? And that got me interested in firms' strategies And here I'm very much in the mold of Alfred Chandler, who said that strategy drives structure, not the other way around. So businesses' profit strategies are what drive their industrial structure. And what you can see in the broadest possible terms is that the 1950s to 1980s, and probably before the 1950s as well, but unfortunately not great data, the profit strategy was to get oligopoly or monopoly profits by controlling a large mass of physical capital in a vertically integrated firm. And this had several important consequences. The first was that this large mass of physical capital, usually organized as continuous flow assembly line production, meant you had a lot of potential surplus capacity you could use to keep other firms out of the market. If a competitor emerged, you could just ramp up production, lower your prices temporarily, and crush the competitor. So obviously, corporate strategists knew their Veblen. The second consequence was the imperative to keep that production line running constantly meant, again, in very broad terms, that you needed to have some kind of compromise with workers. You couldn't have strikes all the time. So these strategies generated a structure of vertical integration that did produce a lot of profit for a handful of firms. And those firms then redistributed that profit partly to their workforce, which in the past, remember, included not just the iconic workers of the assembly line era, that beefy male semi-skilled worker on the assembly line, but also the people in the canteen, the people doing accounting, the people cutting the lawns, the people guarding the warehouses, the people in the warehouses. So broadly speaking, that's what the 50s to 80s looked like. The problem that that strategy faced was that it, as Marxists would say, internal contradictions, or as I like to say, suffered from endogenous decay. And the decay was three things. First, three things that all reflected a loss of control by elites. The first was that there was a generational change in the semi-skilled workforce from the Depression and World War II generation, which was willing to accept the pretty horrible working conditions on the assembly line in exchange for stability and income. But their kids, not to say that the kids are not all right, but their kids didn't want that. And they began going on strike to get industrial democracy and some kind of control over the assembly line. So that was problem number one. They exhausted the exhaustion of a docile working male working force. The second thing that was a big change was the exhaustion of docile female labor and household labor. Second feminist movement starts. Women want to get into the labor market. And this causes also a breakdown of the tight labor markets that characterized the 1950s. The third thing was a loss of control over the former colonies because the whole Fordist model depended on cheap oil. And again, to keep this kind of short, the Gulf states said, we want a bigger share. And if you're not going to give it to us, we're going to jack up prices. And the reason this is endogenous decay or a contradiction, these things are contradictions, is that all of these things emerge from the very success of the model in terms of its growth in the US economy and its expansion globally. So to put it into three sentences, once everybody had cars, it's no surprise that oil supply couldn't keep up with oil demand. Once everybody had assembly line labor, labor processes, it's no surprise that you run out of a docile male working force. And once you run out of a docile male working force and you begin to mobilize women, it's no surprise that the mom will stay at home cooking, cleaning, and shopping compromise breaks down. So that's where we were, and where we've gone to is a new profit strategy in relation that reacts to that breakdown of the old model. And the new profit strategy looks something like this: control intellectual property rights, which are patents, trademarks, brand, and copyright. These things give you essentially a monopoly. A patent is essentially a monopoly. You know, a patent says for the next 20 years. Nobody else can make this thing. A copyright says for the next 105 years, Mickey Mouse is yours. No one else can do Mickey Mouse or Iron Man or any of these other things. And this profit strategy led to the disintegration of these formerly vertically integrated firms. And the idea was to concentrate the source of profit, which was the intellectual property rights, away from the sources of trouble, which were these very militant working workers of the 1970s, and away from the risks in holding lots of physical capital, which you might not be able to run continuously. So the strategy said, push big iron out of your firms, push capital goods out of your firms as much as possible, push unnecessary worker out of your firms as much as possible, and instead be asset light and labor light, except you keep the high human capital labor because those are the folks who generate the intellectual property that you wrap a property right around. Now, two things here are really important. One is that that strategy produces a legal division across firms, but de facto, not de jure, the firms that control the intellectual property still have enormous control over the whole production process. So two quick examples, and then I'll talk about the consequences. First, of course, all those folks out there who have iPhones, if you're unfortunate and you drop that iPhone and it breaks open, you'll see it's full of a lot of physical parts, but nothing in that iPhone is actually made by Apple. Nothing physical in the iPhone is made by Apple. Apple writes software. Apple designs the interface and the look and the feel of the phone, but all the parts come in from other places, and all the assembly is done by contract assembly firms. So an iPhone might have, obviously, Apple software running on chips that are designed by STM, a European semiconductor firm, or by Toshiba, Japanese semiconductor firm, or even Apple's own rival, Samsung, and then assembled by Hon Hai, which is usually known as Foxconn, in a factory in China, or by Pegatron in a factory in China or India. So what you have there is a three-layer economy in which you've got an intellectual property rights firm, Apple, coordinating production by capital-intensive producers, that's the chip makers, and having those chips assembled into phones by the labor-intensive firm in China. And that structure, that three-level structure, also is replicated in other parts of the economy. And in fact, even though we think of this as something that the tech sector started, it actually originates in the fast food and hospitality sector. So let's rerun that whole structure again. Yeah. Hi, I'm McTaco Bell, a mythical fast food franchise. And what do I actually own? I own a whole bunch of brands. I own formula for the products that you're going to eat, but I franchise the right, I license the right to use those symbols and use those formula to entrepreneurs. And you can't see me, but I'm putting that in quotes because these people are actually glorified managers. That's why this is de jure separated, but de facto not, to people who run the own and run the actual restaurants. And those folks hire in cheap labor. And with the fast food franchises, they're direct employers. So it looks like only two levels. But if you go to the hospitality sector and we talk about the mythical hotel company, Hilton Omni, then you see exactly the same thing. The hotel companies do not own properties anymore for the most part. So Hilton, for example, which is a real company, owns approximately 13 buildings. In the past, they owned almost all their buildings. Right. That's the
Hilton only owns 13 of their buildings.
Yeah. And so 1950s, 1960s, Hilton looks like those big factory firms. They own a big chunk of physical capital, the buildings. They systematically sell them off in the 90s, even more so in the 2000s after private equity takes over. And now they have 13 properties, which are the kind of highest class signature properties. Everything else is a licensing of their 16 different hotel brands. And there are, I think, 4,000 or 5,000 different trademarks to a variety of real estate investment trusts, which own the buildings and which themselves then subcontract management to hospitality management firms that use a mix of their own labor and subcontracted labor. So this is why I call the current economy the franchise economy, because it starts in the literal franchise sector, fast food franchises, and then is adopted by tech and also emerges out of the old vertically integrated firms. So if we again rerun this scenario for the car companies, what have they done? They used to be vertically integrated doing intellectual property production internally, right? Engine design, advertising. Advertising is where you get brand, right, and trademark from. So they manipulated our emotions. They designed cars. That's the IP part. They built cars, and they built cars with parts they largely produced themselves. So General Motors generated 70% of its value internally. And as I said before, they had all these extraneous workers rolling around doing things. But the car companies today are one of these mid-level firms like Toshiba or STM. They have pushed out all the low-wage, low-value-added production, particularly components. So in the 90s, Ford and General Motors will spin out Visteon and Delphi as producers of parts. Visteon and Delphi will move production to Mexico, cheap labor, and other places with cheap labor. The car companies themselves, Ford and GM, but you could also look at Volkswagen. I mean, all of them do the same thing. Car companies themselves struggle to master the rising importance of software, et cetera, and largely fail. And so now they're kind of in the middle, in this middle layer, sandwiched between the cheap producers of components on the one side, and on the other side, the producers of the electronics and software that actually constitute most of the value of a car today. If you, again, don't do this at home, if you take your car apart, you'll see there's a lot of steel and a lot of aluminum and a lot of plastic. And in volume, that's the bulk of the car. But in terms of value, the value in the car these days is the engine control module, the cruise control sensor, things like that. So if you take your VW Golf apart, up in the front, there's a small black plastic piece of electronics, which is approximately 2 inches by 2 inches by 1 inch. And what that is the cruise control sensor. It's made by, depending on what model you have, Siemens or Bosch. And that costs $1,000. And a VW Golf is a $22,000, $23,000 car. So just make the math easy. About 5% of the value of the car is this one piece, which is a chip and a sensor. Okay. So the car companies these days also are in this kind of three-level structure. So again, to kind of sum up, we go from high corporate strategy is get oligopolistic profits by control of physical capital in a vertically integrated firm, strategy leading to structure. And now we're in a world in which the corporate strategy is get monopoly profits from intellectual property rights in a vertically disintegrated structure with these, in ideal type terms, these three different kinds of firms, but in which you still exercise considerable control. And the last bit about that considerable control does need some comment. So a few sentences on that. If you go into a hotel run by Marriott or Hilton, of course, you see all the branding. You talk to people behind the counter and they talk to you with a script. And the script comes from Hilton or Marriott. They are controlling their brand image down to the smallest details, which means they're very much involved in regulating what happens in these firms that theoretically they have no control over. And the same thing is true in the tech world, where Apple supervises production of its phones by Hon Hai, all the way down literally to the shop floor, where you will find machine tools that Apple owns being run by Hon Hai employees, but supervised by Apple employees. So de jure, Hon Hai is a completely different firm. It does contract work for a whole lot of electronics firms. De facto, in relation to Apple, it is subject to considerable control.
And that de jure split actually matters, right? Because it changes the way that, for instance, like workers can organize to take control of their workplace.
Yeah, absolutely. It matters in two ways. The first is that if in the old days, whatever profit you might have gotten from your amazing manipulation of emotions through your advertising campaign around your cars was blended with the probably somewhat also equally amazing profits from controlling the assembly line. But now these profits are segregated into different firms, And because the owners of the IP have monopoly, they have stronger bargaining power than the other two layers, especially the bottom layer, the labor-intensive layer. So profits tend to get segregated into these intellectual property firms. So that's the first consequence. The second consequence is that there is less sharing of profit with workers because legally, workers in the second and third layer are not part of the firm that collects the profits. Now, in the US, this is actually hugely important because the 1974, maybe it's 1975, I always forget, Employee Retirement Income Security Act, ERISA, says that if you give a benefit to one worker, you have to give the same benefit to all workers. There's a few small exceptions to that rule, but basically it means if you give your software engineer a 5% 401k contribution and health insurance, and you're also employing a janitor, you have to give the janitor a 401k contribution and health insurance. But if these folks are separated into different legal entities, right, the software engineer is your employee, and you give her the 401k and the health insurance because she's critical to your operation, but you hire in contract cleaners, maybe even contract accountants, they're somebody else's problem. They're in a different firm. And so you're under no obligation to provide those benefits. And that's the primary mechanism for sharing profits, because benefits these days constitute typically 25 to 30% of the wage bill, mostly because health insurance is outrageously expensive. In other countries, it's a little more complicated because national welfare states separate out the what we think of as benefits in the US. So everyone's getting the same thing for the most part. But it still matters because the old centralized bargaining systems of the 1950s, 60s, 70s have disappeared. And there's now a lot more bargaining at the sector and the firm level. And so, again, if I'm in the electronics industry in Germany, and I negotiate with the union for that industry, that doesn't necessarily help wage bargaining for people who are not unionized, who are the subcontracted cleaners. It doesn't necessarily help people in the machinery industries. And so it's not the problem there is not as acute as in the US, but it still can be seen. So again, in a country like Germany, if you look at market wages, what people get from their employer before taxes and transfers, the inequality of market wages in Germany is essentially the same as the inequality of market wages in the US. And then the welfare state smooths some of that out. But that's also because of the expulsion of low wage, low skill labor from the old firms that used to have them as part of their whole employee base. Or to put it differently, the guys who used to make the low-end parts in Germany are now Hungarians and Ukrainians, with the Hungarians doing the assembly of cars and the Ukrainians making cheap parts. So they're also not included in the welfare state part.
So that was like a super helpful like tour through the two big eras of late 20th century political economy. I want to back up a little bit though and ask about contingency and maybe roads not taken. So, you know, people talk about Kalecki moments when the high pressure economy generates political turmoil, essentially, because full employment, you know, this stuff that you were talking about, where full employment, it makes workers confident, and self-confident workers ask for more. And then the social system has to go one of two ways: either advance into more planning, more control, more socialization of investment, more kind of like state, you know, keeping the lid on the elites as workers make these advances, or not. And we know what happened in the late 60s, early 70s is the answer was not. And so we get this three-tiered structure. But I wonder, to what extent was there an alternative path? And to what extent was there an alternative path? What could have been done to prevent this at the time?
Yeah.
If anything.
Yeah. So I'm kind of skeptical that there was really an alternative path, partly because historically, when we see capital forced into some compromises with workers, it's usually because they don't have an exit option. And so in the New Deal, there was no exit option for American capital. Global capital movements shut down. There was no ability to threaten an investment strike because no one was investing anyway. That was the whole reason we had a Great Depression. Similarly, in Europe, if you go back even farther, and we say, why is it that in Scandinavia, we have these more worker-friendly welfare states. The answer is that at the critical moments of industrial conflict, most of the firms in those countries were too small to exit. You know, we're talking about firms with 50 employees who face incredible language and communication barriers. This is around the time of the First World War or this or the 1920s. How are they going to like exit? Right? They can't really exit anywhere. So the exit option, the lack of an exit option is what forces capital to the bargaining table. And in the late 1960s, 1970s, as the big wave of strikes rolls out and as the former raw materials colonies do their version of a strike, which is like oil embargoes and efforts to form cartels, capital did have firms did have an exit option because this was the era in which trade barriers are falling and in which it becomes more possible to move investment capital around the world. And again, this was already happening. And here the electronics industry is a leader. The first Texas Instruments production facilities in Singapore date back, I think, to 1960, early 1960s. The rise, the emergence of the Mexican maquiladora sector. These are small factories on the border that are free of customs duty. They're basically in a free trade zone with the U.S. Also dates back to 1965. And again, critically, it's the car industry that's doing this. They're the first ones to take advantage of this. So firms had an exit option in the late 1960s, early 70s, and they exploited it. The whole process of reorganizing corporations around the new strategy is a process of saying, okay, we disinvest from our big factories with militant unions, and we invest in smaller factories in right-to-work states in the U.S. South, in the Third World, or if you're in Europe, you're going to Spain and Portugal, which is at that time their Mexico. So capital had an exit option. But the scenario, if there had been no exit option, what does the scenario look like? The scenario would have been something like unions bargain for more control over the factory floor and in return promise higher productivity, fewer stoppages, better quality. You can see a perverse version of this in the Toyota system, which involved a lot of consultation with workers. So workers in the Toyota system, and here's why it's perverse, are essentially forced through peer pressure and social pressure to generate suggestions for improving production. That's how you get those pretty consistent 3% a year productivity increases at Toyota. But you could see an industrial democracy version of that, where the engineers sit down with the workers and they discuss better ways to run the assembly line. And critically, more humane ways with more worker rotation, the elimination of stupid jobs through better engineering. And in the Swedish automobile industry of the early 70s, this actually is the corporate response. So if you think about Volvo as a very small player in the world auto industry, their exit options were a little bit limited, right? They're not General Motors, which can exit to Canada, exit to Mexico, exit to Brazil, exit to South Korea. They don't have the financial resources, and they don't critically have the production run. They're making only about 250,000 vehicles. They don't have the production run to justify more factories. So when they're confronted with these strikes, what they do is reorganize production in one factory as an experiment around batch production. Instead of assembly line, some workers bring parts to a stationary assembly point, and workers build the whole car. So it's at least more interesting. You're doing lots of different things every day, as opposed to simply coming in at 6 o'clock in the morning and then for 8 hours putting a wheel onto a car and tightening four nuts every 30 seconds with a break for lunch and some cigarette breaks. I mean, I when I say that, it sounds almost like a joke, but this is what the reality of assembly line work is, and you can see why workers were militant. So the scenario would be more cooperation, humanization of work, and then politically an expansion of social services and maybe a reduction of work time. And again, we know this is possible because we see elements of this in places where capital has a hard time just doing what it wants. So in the German metal industries, so machinery, cars, and metal itself, you see the unions bargaining for gradual reduction of the work week from 40 hours down to 32. You see bargaining around what they call time banks. So demand is a little unpredictable. Maybe demand is up. The company wants to run the factories longer to meet that demand. You work extra hours those weeks, but you then accumulate a bank of time off so that on average, you're at 32 hours. And of course, you see a more comprehensive welfare state. So, I mean, you could see a scenario where that was going on and where there's an expansion of foreign aid to absorb the extra production that comes from higher productivity by transferring production systems and technology to the third world to make them bigger customers for the stuff that you make, right? That would have been the optimistic scenario. And again, to put that in that kind of, you know, short paragraph, it would have been something like, okay, domestic Keynesianism has run into problems because of these endogenous dynamics. Let's try global Keynesianism, some kind of global class compromise with rising incomes outside the US to facilitate a massive shift of production one level up into the production of capital goods and new technology, which means more humane work, et cetera. And the new international economic order would have been part of that deal. What that was, again, in one sentence trying to do kind of metaphorically was expand the Agricultural Adjustment Act, price stabilization and insurance to raw materials production in the third world. Beautiful. So it would have basically a global new deal didn't happen.
So The road not taken is scaling the system up to the world system.
There would have probably been another endogenous decay, right? I mean, again, if you give everyone cars, you eventually run out of oil. And we saw that in real life. If you think about this in terms of a gradual global relocation of automobile production and consumption and a gradual relocation of automobile production systems out of the US and Western Europe and Japan. So, I mean, first from the US to Western Europe and Japan, which gives you the first oil crisis, and then out of Western Europe and Japan to Mexico, Spain, Portugal, Korea, and then some other countries, Brazil, and then eventually China and India. When China and India become big consumers of internal combustion engines, which is the 2000s, you end up with another oil shock. That's the oil shock that precipitates the housing crash in the US. So we probably would have had the same kind of endogenous decay, but the politics would have looked different because instead of having 30 or 40 years of climate denial and let's double down on fossil fuels, people would have probably been saying, this is not going to end well. Let's think about ways to get away from this. Maybe we should have better fuel standards. Maybe we should think about electrification. I mean, these things were on the table in the 80s and 90s. General Motors was making a battery electric vehicle in the 90s, but with regular lead acid car batteries. So limited range. Yeah. And there was a Norwegian company called Think, which was making a small urban electric commuter. Now, granted, one in four people in Norway lives in Greater Oslo. Okay. So, I mean, we're talking about, you don't need much range. They're not taking 300 mile driving vacations. And when they go 300 miles, they're on the train. So this kind of thing depends, the ability to mass market something like that Think vehicle, you know, with the battery technology of the 90s depends on the market and geographical structure. It probably would not have worked in the US, but the critical thing is the demand at the margin, right? So if we're producing, let's again say this is the happy scenario, in the 1980s, there was already a recognition of climate change. You see that in novels. You see that in documents. So we can say there's recognition in the 90s that there's a problem. People put their heads together and they say, okay, let's try electric batteries as a solution. And so you get this kind of primitive 1990s electric vehicles, which become the vehicle of choice in the new marginal consumers because they're not traveling very far, right? The person in Brazil commuting from a suburb to the office if they're not on the bus can use one of these vehicles, charge it at work, go home. They don't need a 250 horsepower SUV, but that's what they're getting now. So that happy scenario might have avoided these kinds of endogenous decays, but it didn't happen.
I wanted to ask one other question about the transition before we maybe get into some of the other unhappy effects of the road that was taken, which is that it seems like the way that you describe these two systems, the sort of two-tiered or the mid-century system and the three-tiered one, it seems clear how the current system is like very advantageous for owners of capital and for the people in charge. And so I'm curious why didn't they make that transition earlier? Like if it's, you know, they get to have all the profits and none of the, you know, demands on that workers. They share. Yeah, none of the workers. Like why didn't they do that in the, you know, 40s or 50s or before the time when they did? And, you know, was that about just there wasn't the internal contradiction, so they didn't feel the need to, or was there a, you know, any sort of changes in technology or policy that allowed the creation, or, you know, what kept it from falling apart before it did?
Yeah. So four things. First, let's just throw out the technology argument. Technology is malleable. It's certainly the case that improvements in information and communication technology allowed for more control at a distance. But I mean, the reality here is that Ford was running and General Motors were running global production empires in the 1910s and 20s. Ford's in Brazil in 1917. Ford and General Motors are in Britain, I think, in 1920, 21, and in Germany shortly after. So, and little known fact, Ford's first overseas factory actually was in Copenhagen. So you could run this kind of global production system with, you know, regular landlines, you know, no computers. To the extent that the technology mattered, it was the absence of electrification and those landlines that hindered companies from moving production to low wage zones. So if you're General Motors or Ford in the 1920s, you might like the idea of running away to the American South, where there was a huge pool of cheap labor, but you run into reality, which is, oh yeah, there's limited supplies of electricity, there's no telephone lines, all those things are put in place by the New Deal. So point one, the technology is malleable. There's a lot of different ways you can organize automation. There's a lot of different ways that you can use communication technologies. It doesn't determine corporate structure. Okay, point two, it's not as if the big profitable firms of the 1920s, 30s, 40s, which were the oil companies, the car companies, and AT&T, a regulated monopoly at the time. It's not as if they didn't want to keep all the profit for themselves and squeeze labor. There was a distributional conflict between capital and labor. And the problem that the companies faced was that the strategy of having large masses of specialized equipment organized in continuous flow assembly line production systems was vulnerable to strikes. And so their very profitability depended on having these systems, which allowed them to get an oligopoly position by enabling them, as I said before, to threaten new entrants with a price war. So if you think about the car industry, we, of course, these days think Ford, General Motors, oh yeah, maybe Chrysler, which is now part of Stellantis. And we forget, oh yeah, there was Packard, there was Kaiser, there was Hudson, there was eventually a merger of firms into American Motors. So there were struggles among firms for market share. And when a company like Kaiser, which starts out as a shipbuilding company, moves into aluminum, says after World War II, oh, hey, we know how to make ships. How much harder can it be to make cars? It is actually a little harder, but how much harder can it be to make cars? We can make cars and enter the car market, which they try to do. And the response by General Motors Ford is to lower prices in the competing segments, expand output, and basically destroy the profitability of Kaiser Automotive. So the profit strategy depended on these big investments in continuous flow production. But that strategy, of course, created the risk that a shutdown of the line might happen because of strikes. And firms had already realized that they needed to give workers something to protect against shutdowns. So Ford's famous $5 a day doubling of wages was not about some clever idea of
aggregate demand.
If I give my workers money, they'll buy my cars, because the market for those cars was actually the farming sector. It was, OMG, I'm losing my entire workforce every 3 months because they can't stand the pace of work. So there was already a sense that you had to share some of the profits. And the question was, how do you do that? And Ford basically generates not just a higher wage to do that, but also an internal welfare state, right? So the American, and they're not unique in this, the so-called American Plan welfare programs, that's the formal name, American Plan, was the idea coming from Herbert Hoover and other people who wanted less class conflict and continued ownership of capital by capital to mute worker unrest by offering pensions, health care, not health insurance, and sometimes housing subsidies and higher wages, but in the context of a firm, each firm doing its own thing. And you could have a world, you could imagine a world in which there's no sit-down strikes and no Second World War. Well, hard, but you could imagine that world where the American plan welfare system persists. Because actually, if you think about the American welfare state today, it looks a lot like that. Every firm with its own plan, at least for the under 65 non-retired part of the workforce.
So as to why it didn't, the transition didn't happen earlier. So technology is not the issue.
But you're right.
And there was a strategy of labor
motivation
management.
Motivation was not the problem. Yes.
Right.
So three, what makes the transition happen is the rise of worker militants. And it's, again, these two waves. 1930s, workers realize, workers in the assembly line continuous flow industries realize they can shut the line down. They don't need everybody to shut the line down. A small group of militant workers can shut the line down. So here you have to imagine two factories. Hi, we're in the garment industry. We're sewing clothing together. Every sewing machine is in some sense its own factory. So if worker one at station one stops working, nothing happens to the other stations. You're the owner. You just fire that person. You call the police up. You haul them out. Production continues at the other, let's say, 99 sewing machines. But in an assembly line situation, let's say we have 100 stations. Again, 10 people go on strike. They sit down. You bring the police in to drag them out. But in the meantime, production has stopped. And there's a risk of damaging these machines. And the other workers are watching and thinking, this is probably not such a great place to work. And so maybe they become more militant also. And so there the technology matters, but remember, it's the strategy that determined what the technology looked like. So you have the first kind of big class compromise in the 30s, 40s, 50s, which was workers saying to owners, you share profits with us, workers in these core industries, because remember, profits were still highly concentrated. Workers saying, you share profits with us, better wages, stable income and employment, you know, welfare tied to our jobs, health insurance and pensions. You do that and we'll let you control the assembly line. You can determine pacing. And that compromise holds until the second generation of workers comes in and they're like, again, WTF, this is incredibly boring, incredibly inhumane, incredibly exploitative. We want something else, and it's not just money. So that's the trigger for the transition, that second breakdown of that second in that second phase. And again, it's not that firms weren't thinking about ways to do this. Already in the 1950s and 60s, General Motors and Ford begin moving production to the American South. But now it's an American South with hydroelectric dams, telephone lines, federal highways, okay? Which, by the way, is the last bit here, public policy. So they already were thinking about doing that. And again, it's not as if the electronics industry, which is in some sense starting from scratch, so not quite, but looking at the world and saying, okay, I'm a new entrant. I'm Texas Instruments. I start in the 30s as a small operation. World War II makes me big. Oh, hey, there's semiconductors out there. Can we do something with them? So they're kind of a newish firm, unlike RCA, which starts in the 1920s. Maybe we should not put our labor-intensive, low-skill assembly-type operations in America. We'll go, again, as I said before, we'll go to Singapore, where wages are really cheap. So they're already, they're in some sense born globalized and de jure separated. But even then, they weren't completely convinced of the de jure part. So Texas Instruments production facility was owned by Texas Instruments. And similarly, Apple, which is in many ways iconic of this three-level franchise economy, initially owned its own production facilities in East Asia, in Singapore, as well as its own production facilities in California. So they were originally a vertically integrated firm, write software, build computers, other people's components, because semiconductors, in fact, are very expensive to produce. The tool is very expensive to produce. The factory's expensive. It's not like that firms woke up in the 1970s and said, OMG, there's a bunch of strikes going on. Now what? They were already looking for ways, but the strikes are the big motivator. And again, the exit option is now available in a way that it wasn't before. And again, that was the fourth point. The exit option is a function of public policy. U.S. global policy was open up the global trading system, allow, it's a little unclear here, I don't want to say force open, but definitely allow the reopening of financial flows, and also make sure that there are stable places, make sure that allies are stable. And politically, what that meant was it's safe for you guys to invest, right? So if the U.S. is guaranteeing that Taiwan and Korea and much more quietly, Singapore, Hong Kong are militarily protected, have domestic political stability, then it makes a lot of, you know, it makes it plausible that Texas Instruments or Apple could go to Singapore, makes it plausible that General Motors could hook up with a South Korean firm. And by hookup, I mean, I think, again, they owned about 30% of the shares of Daewoo, which no longer exists. But, you know, you couldn't do that in the absence of this public policy. And as I said before, the New Deal, the Federal Highway Act, and AT&T make the American South, Southwest, and Northwest what they are today. Specifically, if you look at American industrial geography, as Paul Krugman has pointed out, 90% of industry was in a rectangle, Milwaukee to St. Louis, St. Louis to Baltimore, Baltimore to Portland, Maine, and back to Milwaukee in the 1930s. But what the New Deal does is the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Colorado River projects, which is the Hoover Dam, and the Columbia River projects in the Northwest, and that brings electricity to the rest of the country, which means you can now run a factory. You don't have to build your own generator. And while they're building transmission lines, they're running telephone lines. So now you can actually call up the factory. And so public policy, hugely important here.
Can I just say how grateful I am that we asked you very difficult questions that aren't even about your articles? And like you have this, like you already have 4 points prepared. That was just an incredible wealth of it.
This is not the first time I've said this.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
I suspected so.
Yeah. I'm 102 years old. I've been asked this question a few times. It becomes catechism.
So returning to your article now, so you make the case that the three-tiered structure is not just bad for inequality, but it's also very bad for growth. Could you explain where that argument is coming from? Because I think we have an under-consumptionist understanding of the lack of growth on this podcast, or that's kind of a theory you've been exploring, but you see it as emerging from low growth is emerging from inter-firm competition and strategy.
Yeah. So I want to say first that there's not a huge amount of distance between your understanding of the problem and my understanding of the problem. Both of us are fundamentally Keynesian. And so the under-consumptionist view is a view that puts the distributional conflict between capital and labor into closer focus. What I'm trying to do in these articles is look at the distributional conflict across firms into closer focus. And if you think about GDP, right, the conventional accounting definition of GDP is C plus G plus I plus net exports, right? So consumption plus government spending net of transfers, which is included in the C, plus I, investment, plus net exports gives you GDP. So if that's the accounting identity, then it must also be true that growth, which is the delta, is delta C plus delta G plus delta I gives you delta GDP. The underconsumptionist view focuses on that delta C. Okay, capital's winning the war against labor, profit share is expanding, C is shrinking, and so the delta on GDP is smaller because there's overproduction. That's absolutely right. That's not a wrong way to view things. And I think Keynes would say that's absolutely right. But what Keynes also really focused on was the investment as the driver of growth. And so when we think about the delta I, then that's behavior by firms. And the I here, by the way, for the audience, investment is not, hi, I'm a rapidly aging political science professor who wants a nice retirement. I invest my part of my salary in buying stock shares. That is not investment as Keynes understands it. That is savings. And so when we're talking about investment, what we mean is the creation of new production processes and ideas, not simply passively buying existing financial instruments. So investment is done by firms, and firms have to have both the will and the ability to invest. And in both cases, this new structure limits the will and ability differently for different firms. If we start at the bottom, it's pretty clear that these small firms producing undifferentiated goods and services, think of companies that are like making brake pads, generic brake pads, or think of companies that are making the plastic case, protective case for a phone, so when you drop your phone, it doesn't open up, or the firms that do janitorial work. I mean, what is their investment level, right? They're not going to invest a lot. So they don't want to invest. They're basically labor exploitative businesses. And they also have, in terms of the aggregate profits they get, not a really big share of the profits. And so there's a little bit of an important possible confusion here. These firms might be highly profitable in the sense of rate of profit because they're highly labor exploitative. But in terms of the mass of profit, they're not a big part of the profit pool. And so macroeconomically, when we think about the macro economy, what matters is how much is being invested. And so they don't want to invest a lot. And even if they wanted to, they wouldn't have a lot of profit volume, a lot of profit mass to invest. Okay. Second tier firms, they actually have to, these are like, hi, I'm the car company. I'm the chip maker. I make machines. I build aircraft, although that's a bit of a hybrid industry. These firms, or I'm food processing, these firms actually have the will to invest because their profitability rests on, again, just like in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, their control over this massive physical capital that deters entry by other firms. If you're in the chip building industry, you know that you have to continuously build new fabs in order to make smaller and smaller chips in order to retain your market share. And you also know that if you're the first to build the new fab that makes the smaller chip, the one with the higher level of integration, that the second mover is, or the third mover, or the fourth mover is probably not going to be willing to invest $10 billion, $15 billion to build a competing facility that might not run at full capacity. So they want to invest, but then there's two problems. Problem number one is they're not generating enough profit. And problem number two is and this is a little bit of a will problem, they're really afraid of creating excess capacity. So if you're in the car industry and your main markets are growing 2% a year, because the population is growing 2% a year, in the US anyway, or you're in Europe and the population actually is stagnant or maybe shrinking, you look at that market and you say, wow, just by Toyotaizing our production, we're getting 2 or 3% productivity gains each year. We can handle market growth with productivity gains. And so why would we invest to build a completely new factory? We might say this factory is obsolete, is run down. It doesn't make sense to refurbish it. But when they're doing that, they're not creating new net capacity. Okay. And again, what drives the economy is not replacement of capital. It's the new investment. It's net capital formation that drives the economy. That's the delta on I, not the steady state I, right? That doesn't generate growth. So they'll cover depreciation, but they won't necessarily create new capacity. And so that level also tends to underinvest because they don't have the resources to invest and they're a little bit scared. And then finally, when we look at the firms that actually capture the bulk of the profits, which are these intellectual property firms, and we think about what they do, you can see that, again, their will to invest is somewhat limited. Their capacity to invest is unlimited, but it's will that matters. So when we think about investment by a company like Apple, what are they doing? Clearly, if they want to generate a new iOS, they will have to buy some sophisticated computer systems to write the code on. But it's a much smaller physical footprint. And it's the physical capital investment that generates a lot of the Keynesian multiplier effects, right? Which is where we agree. Keynesian multiplier effects that drive the economy. When Apple's investing, what they're mostly doing is R&D type investment. So they hire a bunch of coders. Or when Hilton is thinking of new brands, they're hiring a bunch of emotion designers. Or when Nike is making better sneakers, I don't know that they're better, but making new emotions for people, right? They're investing in advertising, but this has much, much smaller multiplier effects. So Apple hires a bunch of coders, it pays them a high salary, they go out into the market and they spend their money on helicopter ski vacations and expensive housing in Cupertino. And so landlords collect the money and they don't invest either, because there's no way to build new housing in California, like up until the last year, let's say. So that investment has very limited multiplier effects. And what happens instead is these firms pile up cash and then they invest it passively. And so just as the top 5% of the US population by income recycles its extra savings to the bottom 90% through the mortgage market, and through payday lending and things like that, the top 1 or 2% of firms that get the bulk of profits recycle those profits as lending to the corporations whose profit streams are just barely able to cover depreciation and sometimes not even that. Now, two things here that are really important. One is we have data, and I'll make a shout out here to Henrik Bessenbinder's work, which I think is really important. And what he shows is that the vast majority of firms do not generate excess returns above a moving one-month American Treasury bills returns. So to put that maybe in a way that's more clear, a typical firm over its life, if you compare the dividends and capital gains it generates, isn't doing any better than if you, as a someone trying to do savings, had simply bought a series of one-month treasury bills. And so basically these firms are simply covering their cost of capital. Shout out to Joseph Schumpeter here and his argument about circular economy, which if you want, you can ask me about later. But most firms are just covering their cost of capital. So instead of investing in new production, the firms that get the big profit volumes are passively recycling it to these low profit firms and keeping them alive, but the delta here is small. One last thing, even though I promised you only two, you know, will and capacity. Where you do see profit at the top level being directed into new physical investment, it's usually happening in a way that reestablishes or reinforces that de facto control. So Apple went to Corning and said, I mean, this is a very typical Apple process, Apple procedure. Apple went to Corning and said, we want a new generation of Gorilla Glass for the iPhones. Apparently, and I say apparently so they don't get sued, apparently iPhone glass is a little fragile. So they wanted the stronger Gorilla Glass. And Corning basically said, we're not willing or able to make that investment in a completely new facility to fabricate this glass. And Apple then said, here's $200 million. We loan this to you through our technology advancement facility. And in return, of course, we get first dibs on this new glass. So Apple, in effect, funding Corning's investment. But doing so, of course, in a way that gives them control over Corning output. So there is some recycling that goes on here. And similarly, Apple invested quite a lot in the design of the new M1 and M2 chips. And that also included advanced payments to the semiconductor fabrication people to secure space. So there is some recycling there that leads to new investment. But if you look at the numbers, what you see is that for the most part, these firms are not doing new investment. The ones at the top are not doing new investment. So when you add all that up, the delta on consumption is limited because workers at the bottom don't get a lot of money. The delta on investment is limited because at the bottom, there is no investment. In the middle, they're afraid to invest. And at the top, they don't need to. And then the last piece of the puzzle here, which is the delta on government, is limited by the fact that with most of the profits going to the intellectual property firms, a lot of profits are easily hidden from the tax authorities. There's an enormous amount of tax avoidance. And we can talk about that if you like. But what that does is limit, in a very real sense, limit government revenues. It keeps the delta small. Although, as we see, post-COVID, the government wants to create money. They can create money.
Well, it strikes me, though, that even as like there's a kind of theoretical similarity between underconsumption and then kind of your diagnosis of the changing structure of production, that they call for different solutions, right? Insofar as like redistribution might kind of solve the underconsumption problem. But I think in order to get at like the problem of like money flowing through the financial system or not, and corporations or not, winding up in investment or not, you're looking at much more far-reaching set of like policy solutions, no?
Correct. So the underconsumption arguments largely come from the 1950s, 60s, when the rollout of mass production to the entire economy and the transfer of mass production technologies to Europe and Japan led to enormous increases in output. And you had a whole bunch of Marxist and also Keynesian scholars focused on the consumption side, right? How can those housewives, because this is the social reality, how can those housewives absorb all this stuff? There has to be some way to put money in the hands of workers. And the diagnosis and the remedy were obvious, right? The unions will bargain for higher wages. And classically, the 1949-1950 Treaty of Detroit between the United Auto Workers and General Motors set the pattern here in the U.S. And that treaty, so-called treaty, was what I talked about before in terms of higher wages, factory floor control. But its specific terms basically said, if productivity goes up by X in the American economy, X percent in the American economy, General Motors will raise wages by X percent plus inflation. And so that meant that demand would grow in line with overall growth of supply. And that solves the underconsumption problem. Today, it's a little different. First of all, because of this three-tier structure, the big firms don't employ as many people as the big firms used to in the past. The numbers are in the article, but I can't remember them. If you look them up, you can like just put your editorial comment in. So they don't employ as many people. So a kind of firm level or even sector level solution won't work. Instead, you need, and that in any case, that only affects the delta C part, the consumption part. Instead, you need bigger political efforts to change the distribution of income and the distribution of power in the economy. So if we say intellectual property rights shift most of the profit in the economy towards those IPR firms, and also to financial firms, which, by the way, have IPR characteristics we can talk about later also, then the solution is regulation that limits that monopoly power. And more generally, there's a problem of monopolies in the economy, not just from the IPR sectors, but also that second level of firm responds to the bargaining power that the IP firms have by merging up. So overall in the economy, you have monopolization, and then that leads to less investment. The second tier firms are merging horizontally in order to absorb potential competitors. And the IPR firms merge, I'll say, vertically, by which I mean they buy up potential new entrants. So Google will buy a Waze's navigation software. It was a threat to Google Maps. Facebook buys WhatsApp, right? It's a threat to messaging. And so you have a problem of monopoly here, but the problem is expressed not the way it was in the 50s, 60s, 70s, as monopoly leads to underconsumption, but instead monopoly leads to less investment. So you need to break these monopolies up. And in the IP sector, that would mean weakening or modifying the terms for these intellectual property rights. So to take not the most important example, but a very clear example, if copyright lasts for 105 years for works by hire, that means that we get less cultural innovation, and less cultural innovation means fewer new firms forming. And those new firms, the absence of those new firms means, again, less investment, because new firms have to invest to grow. So what we get instead is a recycling of comic book, to pick an arbitrary example, a recycling of comic book images from the 1940s, 50s into digitized movie images. And and those new images now have the new copyright term, which goes out another 105 years. And that blocks new entry by cultural creators that might take away some of the profits that the comic book now cinematic universe people, Marvel cinematic universe people, are absorbing. And again, copyright is a political creature. The US Constitution creates copyright. It was 28 years after the life of the author, 28 years or the life of the author. And it's because of lobbying of Congress that it's been extended. And the joke about the Sonny Bono Copyright Act, which is the one that extended copyright to 105, is that it should have been called the Mickey Mouse Copyright Extension Act. So the Congress could act to limit the monopoly effects that come from these IPRs. Second example, pharmaceuticals. There's a huge, huge gap between the price of generics, which are basically cost of production, and the price of branded goods, which are protected, branded pharmaceuticals, which are protected by the patent. And the usual argument here is firms need the patent to recoup the R&D expenses involved in generating a new drug, which could be true if, in fact, they generated new drugs. But again, up until the last few years, most of that investment that the firms were doing was to make copycat drugs. $2 billion was invested to create copycats of Viagra, you know, so to create Cialis and whatever the other one was. So what the pharmaceutical firms mostly do in terms of R&D is subcontract it to smaller firms. And the smaller firms obviously get income, they get credit in the publications, but the patents are owned by the pharmaceutical firms. And the patent is what allows them to reap these very, very high profits. So again, here too, you could legislate changes to the patent rules, or you could legislate bargaining over pharmaceutical prices. I mean, it's not an accident that European states, that the cost of healthcare in European economies is half the cost of what it is in the US as percentage of GDP, because all those countries negotiate prices of pharmaceuticals. And if you look at American labor law, which says that a driver for Uber is an independent contractor and therefore is theoretically a firm and therefore cannot act collectively with other Uber drivers, because that's a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. Yeah, you can see that there's a need to change law to actually get a grasp on reality, which is that these people are workers. Or similarly, if you look at the Starbucks unionization drive, why is it that the Starbucks unionization drive is happening on a site-by-site basis rather than company-wide? Uh-huh. American labor law says that it is establishments, not firms, that are the site of unionization. And an establishment is the Starbucks down the corner. Uh-huh. And the one that's two blocks away from you instead of one block away from you is a different establishment and needs to have its own election. So labor law changes would also help in terms of allowing workers to organize, which would help with Delta C, but also helps with the Delta I, because as workers unionize and as wages go up, firms will substitute capital for labor, which we actually already see in the last few years in response to the COVID labor shock.
And McDonald's. Automated order. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, you need much more far-reaching things. Mm-hmm. You need a lot of far-reaching things, right? We're talking about anti-monopoly. antitrust legislation and critically litigation. We're talking about really changing American labor law. We're talking about big changes to patents and copyright.
On that front, I mean, do you see, of course, you know, this is a tall order, obviously, but necessary. How do you see do you see a way forward in terms of political coalitions? Or, I mean, I know, you know, one of the things about these IP firms is that they spend an enormous amount on lobbying. Like, that is a thing that they invest in to preserve, because so much is about the law and policy of their profit strategy. Yeah, do you see sort of a glimmers of a way forward, or of a way to structure a political coalition that could actually affect these changes to IP law, to labor law, et cetera, that you're describing?
So there's clearly a move to unionize that bottom level. And that, of course, would help the existing unions in the middle level. And there clearly is some political will to help that. The Obama administration's National Labor Relations Board made two rulings that essentially said, you companies at the top of this de jure separated but de facto integrated firm actually have to be responsible for workers at the bottom. So in the Browning-Ferris decision, they said that Browning-Ferris, which is a waste management company, was responsible for the subcontracted workers at its sorting facilities. And in the hypothetical world where Hillary Clinton wins the election in 2016, not Donald Trump, you might have had an expansion of that ruling to cover other companies, other sectors. So it might have become a more general rule that lead firms cannot escape responsibility for their subcontract. The Trump administration killed that. They overturned they of course got to appoint three members to the NLRB, which has five members. They overturned their own ruling. The Biden administration, 2020 forward, is making moves to try to reinstate that ruling, right? So there obviously is some support for that in the Democratic Party, or at least in the Biden administration. And that would be a big help. Second thing is what we've seen in the Biden administration is a much more aggressive, which is not to say hugely aggressive, but it's much more relative to the past, much more aggressive efforts at antitrust. So they've blocked more mergers. They've opened more inquiries, which are usually a signal to firms that you better not do this. Or that you will be investigated, so you better behave better. And this is the effect of having Lina Khan and Chopra on the FTC. So clearly there is space for something like this. Now, one place where there is probably going to be, where there's potential for a big fight is around health care and health insurance. Health insurance is, of course, largely parasitic. It's parasitic on the rest of the economy. And so there is potential coalition for among firms that actually produce things to support further strengthening of the things that happened in the Affordable Care Act, that is to say the ACA, Obamacare 2010. And that's for very simple reasons. If you're, you know, a car company, in the U.S., not just GM, but also VW, Toyota, you have a workforce that is going to get injured. Your health insurance costs are high because healthcare costs are high. And so you potentially are part of a coalition to do something to control those costs. And that matters because the pharmaceutical firms capture about 5% of profit in the U.S. economy, as measured for publicly listed firms anyway. Yeah, big number. And about 4% globally for those 20,000 global ultimate earners. Most of that is from the U.S. market. And so the users of those things have an incentive to organize. But this is an issue, you know, but of course, this is a question of salience, right? What do they care about? The big picture here, and this is why the Republican Party constantly gets support from corporates. The big picture here is that much of the increase in profitability much of the increase in the profit share of GDP comes from lower taxes on corporations. So if you're a corporation, right, again, let's put ourselves in the head of the imaginary firm in each of these three tiers. We're a highly profitable, high profit volume tech company or emotion management company brands. We have a small workforce. We know the only way to hire them anyway is to give them health insurance. But what do we really care about? What we care about is making sure our brand, our IP is protected, and lobbying to do that yields a lot more than lobbying to fix the healthcare mess. Hi, we're in the middle. Tax cuts, again, here are a huge percentage of our increased profits over the last few decades. Again, what are we going to lobby on? We might be a little more inclined to lobby because, again, we have this older workforce more likely to get injured, but we've got other big problems, not least of which is, 2008, 2010, collapse of the market, COVID, collapse of our markets. We're out there lobbying for paycheck protection, subsidies, et cetera. And then in the bottom, of course, small businesses, they don't want to give health insurance. Their profitability is a function of labor exploitation. Push wages down, try to keep prices up. The National Federation of Independent Businesses was one of the most vehement foes of the ACA. And anyway, the ACA only covers firms over 50 employees. And the long, long, long tail of the 20 million firms in the U.S. is really small firms. It's high. I'm the pizza franchise or the fast food franchise with 30 employees or 49. Absolutely not going up to 50. I don't care what the demand looks like. You just use overtime, right? So they're a force against any expansion. So there are players that would like this. Those first two layers have an interest in this, but again, in terms of issue salience, may not be their top priority. And all of them, again, if you think about what is their attitude towards the labor relations stuff, all of them have an interest in not being responsible for those other workers. I mean, this is business school stuff, right? Reduce your risks, magnify your monopoly power. I gave a very early version of those, what became those American Affairs articles at Harvard a long time ago. And the discussant was from Harvard Business School. And he said, this is an interesting paper, but there's nothing new here. This is just what we teach our students to do.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was like,
I mean, it's good to get confirmation.
Yeah. This was like 2017, I think. And I was like, or 2016. And I was like, okay, great. Now, if I can only convince the political science journal reviewers that this is reality. So, I mean, I would say I'm neither optimistic nor pessimistic. I don't like to make predictions about the future because, as the guy said, it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future. The positive signs on the horizon are a rejection of the Republican Party in the most recent election, or at least parts of the Republican Party in the most recent election, which is positive because the Republican Party is not interested in fixing the problems with tech and IP-related industries in a way that would help investment. They're interested in just getting them on board as a source of funding and political support. And of course, they're hostile to changes in labor relations. So there is space for more antitrust, more labor relations reform, possible reform of the IP stuff. Notably, Mickey Mouse goes out of copyright next year. So if you want to sort of test of what's going to happen, watch what happens around copyright next year. And then we'll see what the interest in the Democratic Party is, because they at least will have a majority in the Senate. House, of course, at this moment is up for grabs.
We should know we're recording this on the 15th of November.
Yeah, thanks.
So in your second article, we've spent a lot of time talking about intellectual property and the intangible economy. But in your second article, you argue that financialization is kind of a frame that has obscured a lot of what you're talking about, and that finance and these IPR firms are more similar than people would expect. And so maybe that's one way to hook in people who are somewhat familiar with that frame, to bring them into sort of your worldview. Can you explain like what you were trying to do in that article with financialization?
Sure. I'm not that smart. So the basic strategy was the same, which is that just like people were arguing from all firms against all workers framework, And what I wanted to do was to disaggregate firms to see who actually was getting the money. In the financialization article, I'm attacking people who say all finance as a general phenomenon against all other firms. And I do that in order to say the two things you mentioned. One is that it's not all financial firms. It's, again, a narrow slice of financial firms that capture most of the profit in the financial sector. And two, that those firms are more like the IPR firms than we think. And actually three, that there is some symbiosis between these firms. So let's walk through each of those things. The first is finance, of course, is a huge range of different activities. Finance is my paycheck gets deposited in my local bank. I swipe my credit card. Another financial firm is involved. When I go to buy my latte, I don't actually drink lattes, but to buy my latte. And at the end of the month, I transfer money from one bank to another to settle the claim against the credit card. And finance is also mortgages. Two-thirds of bank activity is mortgage in most countries, actually, not just the US. But finance is also high. We've created a tailored derivative that theoretically solves some problem that your firm faces. Now, when you look at those activities, what you're seeing is something like that three-level pattern, which is to say you've got a lot of small financial firms that individually have high rates of profit, but don't add up to a lot of money. The bulk of American debt, typically in any year, 70-75%, is mortgages. The second largest category varies from year to year. It used to be automobiles, and now it's student loans. The third is credit cards. The fourth is everything else, which is a few percent. Okay, that's your payday lenders. So the bulk of profit is coming from the mortgage sector to the extent that we're looking on the debt side for people. And that activity is highly routinized and by design. What Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, government-sponsored entities have done, enterprises have done, is standardize the mortgage process for roughly two-thirds to 75% of American mortgages. It's a standardized good. So there you're like those middle tier firms. You're kind of competing on production efficiencies and volume. How many mortgages can you turn over? You collect the fees, you sell the mortgages to Fannie Mae. The more that you turn over, the more fees you collect, the higher your profits. Where the real money is made is in that last category, which is these custom made derivatives. And that's a handful of firms. It's the investment banks or the consolidated banks that now have an investment bank slice. Like JP Morgan Chase, Citibank. Okay, that's where the real profits are made. And these derivatives also have a kind of standard versus non-standard breakdown. You can buy a standard product like a put or a call option on the S&P 500. And the pricing there is, you know, pennies per thousands of dollars because they're very easy to design. So within the derivatives, where the big money is, hi, I've made you a custom-made derivative. Hi, we've got a solution for your problem. It involves incredibly complicated math that we won't show you. So it's opaque. Our behavior around this incredibly opaque derivative is complicated because we may be taking the other side of the bet. And generating these complicated derivatives is a production process that looks just like what happens in the IT, information technology sector. Hi, I'm Apple. I employ a lot of software engineers, et cetera, using very expensive workstations to produce code. Hi, I'm, JP Morgan, et cetera, employing physicists and engineers using expensive workstations and complicated math to design this derivative. And there are so many of these people on Wall Street that there was an acronym, POWS, like POWs, prisoners. But instead of prisoners of war, it stood for physicists on Wall Street. And these things are protected by patents. That's the critical connection. It's not just production process, but also they're protected by patents. So banks are now heavily involved in generating patents, and that's what protects these derivatives. And why are they deliberately opaque? If any other firm could copy them, and if they're not protected by a patent, then they become a standardized commodity, just like the put or the call option on the S&P 500. So point one, profits are concentrated. Point two, they're concentrated in these derivatives, which are basically IP products. And then point three, most of the financialization arguments say that the problem with finance is the shareholder value model, which forces firms not to invest and instead to take whatever profits they're generating and redistribute them as share buybacks or dividends. And this is to a certain extent true, but there's two puzzles around this. The first puzzle is that the iconic cases here are the U.S. because share buybacks and excessive dividend payments are rare outside the U.S. But the argument here is share buybacks, dividend, excessive dividend payments, less investment, less growth. And empirically, it's the U.S. that has more growth, relatively speaking, more GDP growth than these other countries, again, for the most part. More than Europe in the aggregate, although not more than every single European country. But remember, most European countries are small. A country like Denmark is basically the size of the Boston economy. A country like Sweden, basically the size of the Virginia economy. So that's a puzzle that is hard to wrap your head around. The second puzzle is that, again, the U.S. economy is held up as the paradigmatic case of financialization, particularly in relation to households. So the usual story there is, well, American households have really high levels of debt, and the financial industry is parasitic on them. And this, of course, would suppress delta consumption, the delta on consumption. But again, when you look at the data, what you see is the really big debtors are not in the U.S. The countries that have the really high levels of household debt relative to disposable income are actually the Scandinavian economies, the Netherlands, in other words, countries with big, robust welfare states. And the reason is simple. If you take on debt, and particularly if you take on mortgage debt, you're committing yourself to a stream of income over a very long time horizon. How do you know that you'll be able to make those payments? And equally critically, how does the bank know you'll be able to make those payments? Well, if you're in a welfare state that has high level of income replacement, if you're unemployed, that will take care of you when you get sick, where your pension is not subject to market volatility, then actually you can borrow a lot more money. Banks look at you and say, you're a good credit risk. You have a stable income for the next 30 years. So why not lend you money for a house? And those folks, they borrow money. American household debt relative to disposable income is actually below the average for the OECD if we truncate, do it country by country. Not as low as Germany, but not much different from a Germany. And so there, again, the financialization story doesn't make a lot of sense. What does make sense, to me at least, is that the shift to high profitability for the finance industry is part of this more general shift after the 1980s, starting in the 1990s, of profits being captured through this strategy of let's use the monopoly power of intellectual property to maximize our profits relative to our now diminished assets, our physical capital. That seems to be the more general pattern. And so I would lump finance in with the IPR industries, but this is a very contentious claim. And it does run against some of the better known authors in the financialization space, like Greta Krippner and Monica Prasad.
Yeah, I was just going to say, so because Prasad, the argument that you just laid out was like a supply side sort of argument about the relationship between the welfare state and finance. Is like, it's actually, if you're a bank, you want to lend to people who live in a welfare state because they're more secure and they can probably pay it back easier. Whereas she makes an argument about demand, that like credit replaces the welfare state in places where, you know, you don't have access to good healthcare. You have to go into debt if you break your arm, because that's just, I mean, what else are you going to do, right?
So first things, I mean, I know Monica Prasad, and we were at one point sitting on the same stage discussing her book, which is a good book. The differences here are, to a large extent, a difference of not, I don't want to say framing exactly, but what there are differences of what the actual question is. We're trying to answer different questions. Mm-hmm. My question is a fundamentally macroeconomic question. What is it that explains the relatively slow growth we've had from the end of the Cold War forward? Okay. And Monica Prasad's argument is, what is it that explains why there's not a more robust welfare state in the US? So when I look at her argument in relation to growth, my framing of that argument is, Yes, the people who are at the bottom of the income distribution, who are borrowing for healthcare and other things, are borrowing because there's not a more robust welfare state. But at a macroeconomic level, that's not a lot of the debt in the economy. From the point of view of those people, it's crippling, no question. From the point of view of any kind of humane system, it's crazy, no question. But macroeconomically, it's not a lot of debt. Again, to go back to the numbers I put out, at any given time, roughly 75% of household debt is mortgages. That's the big dog. And again, after mortgages, autos, student debt, those are, you put those three together, that's the big dog here. The rest of it is tail. But if you're looking at it from the point of view of humans and households, most of the American households are financially stressed, would be better served if they had a welfare state. And so from that point of view, her argument is totally correct. With Greta Krippner's arguments.
But to the point, it would seem that, like, you know, if we had a more robust welfare state, that wouldn't reverse a lot of the tendencies that we see in terms of financialization and like debt burdens. In fact, it might exacerbate debt burdens in like by making people more secure and more willing to take on debt. No.
Insofar as most American debt is, insofar as the cause of most bankruptcy, which is the problem, is medical debt, it would be a big help to have a bigger, to have a more robust welfare state. The fact that people in welfare states are, the fact that people in more robust welfare states have higher levels of debt, you know, is an interesting thing. The question is, what does it mean? And what it means, I think, is at least two and maybe three things. First, what it means is people in those countries are not really homeowners. They're perpetual renters. Most of the debt in those countries, again, is mortgages. Most of those mortgages, until recently, were interest-only mortgages. And so people are making payments on their mortgage well into retirement. But so what? Their retirement income is stable. So what you have there is a system in which the government basically has stabilized incomes, which is the most important part of the welfare state, stabilized incomes, removed risk from people's lives. And if people then choose to leverage themselves up, okay, it could have, could create problems. And the problems are, what happens if the interest payments go up on your interest-only loan? That's a problem of mortgage system design. In Norway, about 70% of mortgages are what we would call an adjustable rate mortgage in the US, and the term is 1 year. So if interest rates go up globally, as that's happening right now, there's a big problem. In the US, fortunately, mortgages are the one place in the economy that which is debtor friendly. American mortgages are a one-way bet. Again, for the audience probably knows this. If they're homeowners, you take out a fixed rate mortgage for 30 years, interest rates in the economy go up, you shrug your shoulders and go about your business. Interest rates go down, you refinance, and now you've got more money. You can have two lattes in the morning instead of one. And so again, if the increase in debt is household debt is mortgage related, I'm not so worried. The really important thing here is that debtors be able to service their debts. That's important because that's what generates financial system stability. If debtors can service their debts, you'll have financial system stability. And if the mortgage market, which again is the most important one for the mass of the population, if the mortgage market is structured properly, there are no problems. The pre-2008 mortgage market in the US and in other places was properly structured. And by properly structured, what I mean here is this. What banks do, and by the way, what banks should do, we want them to do this, is maturity transformation. Short-term deposits come in, or banks create short-term deposits is the way I prefer to put it. But banks create short-term deposits on one side of their balance sheet. They make a long-term loan on the other side. We want those long-term loans because those are the things that create new stuff. Net, you know, mortgages for new housing, loans for new factories, businesses. We want banks to do that. Those loans typically are longer term, but that creates a risk for banks. They're creating short-term deposits. Depositors can walk in and ask for their money at any moment of the day. On the other side are assets that are hard to liquidate in a crisis. Banks hold mortgages, but you can't liquidate the houses that are the collateral. Banks own loans to companies, but you can't liquidate the factory easily in a crisis. And the way that the government solves this problem in most countries is A, or one, deposit insurance. So depositors are not panicky. B, move the risk of those long-term assets off bank balance sheets in some way, or find ways to make deposits be long-term. So if you look at the German mortgage system, you want a mortgage, you have to put money into the bank over a long period of time to secure the mortgage. So what that provides is a stable source of long-term funding the bank can use to make mortgages to other people before they make yours. In the US, the way we do this is Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. Banks generate a mortgage and they package the mortgages that they've generated over a 2 or 3 month period into a bond. They sell those mortgages to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. Sorry, they banks package those mortgages up, not as a bond, but they sell them en masse to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac package them up as a bond, and they sell them in the long-term capital market. So if you look at banks' balance sheets, what you see is, here's a deposit, which is short-term. Here's a bunch of mortgages, which in principle are long-term, but in practice are also short-term. So banks' balance sheets are short, maturity matched. And if you look at Fannie Mae, what you see is here's a bunch of Fannie Mae mortgage-backed securities, which is long. And here's Fannie Mae borrowing money in the capital markets through issuing its own debt to buy mortgages. And again, this is long. The lenders to Fannie Mae that are buying Fannie Mae's debt are things like insurance companies that know they have to make pension payouts or life insurance payouts. And so they want a long-term asset with a stable stream of income to match their long-term liabilities. And that's the way to properly manage the mortgage market. So in that equation, if you're doing that, a high level of consumer debt around mortgages is not necessarily problematic. The 2008 crisis, to be very simple about it, came about because the investment banks recreated the maturity mismatch that Fannie Mae solved. They were borrowing short-term from money markets to invest long-term in subprime mortgages that they thought would be short-term, but which turned out not to be short-term. And then there was a problem when the collateral behind those subprime mortgages got damaged as house prices began to fall. Anyway, so that's why I'm a little bit different on the facade thing. It's a matter of focus, not my argument contradicts her argument. Yeah. With Krippner, there's a different thing going on, which is Krippner's data is perhaps misleading. Krippner looks at the balance sheets, basically the 10Ks, the annual financial statements from firms, and says, look, a rising share of the profit of these of firms in the aggregate, which is already, you can see, an issue I'm going to have, comes from financial sources, dividends, interest payments. The problem with using the data that way is, again, from accounting definitions. So I'm an American multinational. And by the way, most S&P 500 companies are multinational, and the bulk of profits are the S&P 500 companies. So you can see how compositionally this will drive Krippner's findings. I'm an American multinational. I either generate or assign profits for tax evasion purposes to my overseas subsidiaries. We think about corporations as being unified entities, but they're not for legal purposes. General Motors of the US is a different legally a different corporation than General Motors of Canada. When General Motors of Canada makes dividend payments to General Motors America, that is captured as financial income in its 10K, in its financial filings. When Apple parks profits in Ireland so as not to pay taxes on it, and then it lends those profits to other companies, when those profits are used to buy corporate bonds, the interest on those loans comes back to Apple as interest. It's a financial earning, and then is transmitted maybe back to Apple US as an interest payment. And when, let's say, IBM of US loans money to IBM of France to do something, IBM of France makes interest payments back to IBM US. Again, all this is captured as financial income, but none of it is really financial income in the true sense. What you're seeing there is the way that overseas profits and interest are transmitted back to the US. And so it's a bit of an illusion that financial income has been rising. Now, the financial sector's profits, as a share of total profits clearly have been rising. But again, the question there is, where are those profits located? What kind of activities generate those profits, which I think I answered already. So that would be the main axis of difference between Greta Krepner and me.
No, that's so helpful, though, the way that like corporate balance sheets get chopped up and distributed by globalization just means that we have to approach the data in a totally different way.
Yeah, this is an accounting issue. It's an accounting illusion. Yeah. I mean, the other accounting illusion here, which I think is really problematic, not just for her work, but also my work, is that we really don't know in any easy way where the degree to which private equity firms capture the profit that the IP firms, et cetera, are generating. So this is not true for an Apple, but like Hilton was for many years owned by a private equity firm, and private equity firms own a lot of the fast food franchise firms. And you know, where's that money go?
That's an amazing mystery to have out there and not know the answer to. Wow.
Yeah. Well, like someone else said, we know more about the price of bread at any given moment than we do about corporate profits. Mm-hmm. The National Statistical Agencies, you know, can tell you the price of bread in Cleveland last week, mm-hmm. But they can't tell you in any comparable way what's the profit share in America as compared to the profit share in Britain, and what actually is the profit share. Who gets it?
Gosh, I wish that Andrew was here for this episode, because this is one of the points that he makes again and again, is the politics of data construction, because we can tell you a lot about wages and unit labor costs, but unit profit costs, who knows?
Yeah. So that's a problem that's bigger than me. So I just shrug my shoulders.
All right. Well, we're running up against 2 hours here, and this has been like a marathon and just like such a feast of data. But just one last question before we go is, this summer, since the last of these articles came out, Congress passed the CHIPS Act and the Inflation Reduction Act, and they've been hailed as signifying a new era of industrial policy in the U.S. I'm wondering what your views are on these two acts. Are they steps in the right direction? Are they kind of missing the point? Where do you see the current consensus evolving into? In relation to your arguments.
So to make a really big claim, this is a really big claim.
Drop it on us.
What else is new? We're basically going back to some of the political environment of the 1950s, 60s, Cold War. So we're going back to Cold War. So if we call that Cold War One, we're going into Cold War Two. Cold War One was containment of Russia, sometimes China. Cold War Two is containment of China, Russia being the junior partner there. And we're seeing elements of the old Cold War regime in terms of industry. So if you go back to Cold War One, one thing that stabilized the economy, and this was also something the underconsumption argument stressed, was, hey, defense production, a defense expenditure is 20% of American manufacturing output. And there's huge controls on the flow of technology to Russia. There is regulation of the economy to assure that production goes on. And we are seeing the same. And of course, there was a massive investment of federal resources into R&D and the creation of new technology. That bit has been a pretty persistent feature of policy. The more overt interventions drop out post-Cold War during the franchise era. So I would say what I have done is maybe capture something that was true about the 30 years from 1990 to 2018 or 28 years, but that we are seeing a kind of shift in the big regime here because of the emergence of Cold War II. Now, Cold War I had massive, let's say, biopolitical positive policies, which is the rollout of the welfare state. When we look at Cold War II, what we see, at least initially here, is the industrial policy part without the biopolitical part. CHIPS Act is quite obviously about maintaining technological superiority, not just in terms of what we know we can do, but what we can actually do in terms of building things. The IRA, similarly, is about energy security, and if not enabling reshoring, then enabling nearshoring, which anyway, macroeconomically, is just as good. The reason being that when a Chinese worker finally gets paid their miserable wages, they buy a locally produced refrigerator. But when a Mexican worker gets their miserable wages, they probably buy an American produced or American multinational produced refrigerator. And so it's better for the US economy. And so there is a change on the industrial side because of Cold War II. Biopolitically, it's a little bit harder to see, but again, you know, the whole thing about unionization, healthcare reform, health insurance reform is potentially a big change. And the efforts by the OECD, which translates into the finance ministries of the rich countries, because that's the constituency for the OECD, to get the base erosion profit shifting project to establish a minimum tax on multinationals, also clearly an effort to reduce tax avoidance by the big IPR companies. And again, that's consistent with the kind of tax regime of the first Cold War. So there are ways in which we're moving to a different regime right now. It's not, for all the reasons I talked about before, it's not clear that that undoes all the features. But this is clearly a transitional moment. And in a very narrow biopolitical sense, if COVID turns out to be persistent, and if COVID also turns out to be just first of several, I hope not first of many, you will probably see, you know, a big biopolitical intervention around health. I have been saying to people that what long COVID will do is force the insurance companies out of the market and force companies to look for some kind of federal solution. Because to the extent that long COVID is real, and to the extent that long COVID is debilitating, no one's going to want to carry the cost of that. No one in the private sector will want to carry the cost of that. You're going to have to socialize the cost. So we could be back to a kind of 1950s, 60s industrial policy, biopolitics. We'll see. You guys will see more of it, because given that I'm 102, I'm not long for this. I'm not going to see the end of this.
No. Moses will see the promised land in this case.
Okay, maybe. I mean, well, the new advances in biotechnology actually mean that might be true. So we'll see.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, for this. This was, like, I mean, as I said before, just a feast of information. So yeah, thanks.
Well, thank you guys. Thanks for having me. And looking forward to doing this again, but we'll talk about movies maybe.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Cause your whole thing about, like, vampires and zombies, We didn't even talk, cause you have, like, a whole literary, sort of angle into all of this. Very cool. Okay. Actually, now that we're kind of off the record, I'll hit the stop recording button.
Reviving Growth Keynesianism is produced by me, Nick Johnson. If you enjoyed this discussion, please follow us wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and consider leaving us a positive review, which will help us connect with more engaged listeners like you. More information on our ideas can be found at revivinggrowthkeynesianism.org. There you can also find our Patreon. We would greatly appreciate if you chose to support us. All donations allow us to put out more content for thoughtful listeners like you. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.